Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Medicaid System Creating Woes for Some. This article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. Sunshine Pediatrics generates 90% of its revenue through Medicaid. Because of problems with a new state billing system, the Raleigh practice received its last Medicaid check on June 28, and Dr. Albertina Smith, who runs the practice, estimates the program owes her $26,000. So far, she's been able to pay her two employees and continue to see patients, but she doesn't know how long that will last. Will I be able to do that next week, she poses? I don't know. That's an honest answer. We Care Pediatrics in Rocky Mount generates about 75% of its annual revenue through Medicaid claims. Because of problems with the state's new billing system, the practice's cash flow is lagging by half. Two other practices in rural North Carolina have had to take out a combined $500,000 in lines of credit to keep their doors open. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services switched to a new Medicaid claims payment system called NCTRACS on July 1. Although it has worked for some providers, others are not receiving the proper payments, cannot check eligibility, and are waiting on hold for hours when seeking help through a call center established to handle problems. NCTRACS is functioning well in some areas, and many providers are receiving Medicaid checks, but the problem seems to be that it isn't working for everyone, and those that have problems are not finding easy solutions. If these providers don't get the proper payment soon, they could stop seeing Medicaid patients or, worse, have to close up shop. Despite these problems, Governor Pat McCrory and DHHS have largely praised the system. On July 9, McCrory toured the NCTRACS Command Center with DHHS Secretary Dr. Aldona Woos and CIO Joe Cooper. I congratulate Secretary Woos, Joe Cooper, and the entire NCTRACS team for a successful first few days of operations, the governor said in a statement. The hard work and bold leadership at DHHS is what pushed this critical IT project over the finish line, and North Carolina is thankful for that. Not everyone sees the matter that way. I think that's an infuriating comment, says Lauren Ballou, Director of Operations for MSOC Health, a Chapel Hill firm that works with medical practices to help them operate more efficiently. DHHS officials have repeatedly said that training is available for practices to prepare for the switchover, but practice managers say they find that assertion insulting. The training was not sufficient, says Fran Sembert, advocacy chair for the North Carolina Medical Group Managers Association and director of Eagle Physicians and Associates in Greensboro. They glossed over some really important stuff. Ballou says, "We were prepared. We were all prepared. We were expecting bumps, but this is not a bump. This is a manhole." DHHS has stuck to its guns. Spokesman Ricky Diaz says the system accurately paid $473 million on 13 million claims in the first 3 weeks of operation. Medicaid is projected to pay nearly $13 billion in a fiscal year. Some providers, including Rex Healthcare, have reported no problems with the new NCTRACS system. Diaz says the call center will stay open on Saturday, a day when wait times are dramatically shorter. Our goal continues to be to successfully transition all providers to the new system by working with associations, clearinghouses, and directly with providers, both proactively and through our call center, he says. Tom Murray, a pharmacist and Republican member of the NC House, says he's heard positive and negatives. "We were potentially expecting a Hindenburg crash. That didn't happen," he says. "It hasn't been completely smooth and seamless, but it hasn't been a crash." And now we move down the page to our cover story in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal. And this cover story, this article, beginning of it, takes up the rest of the page. First, there's a very large picture of women in white lab coats working at Lenovo, putting together some motherboards. The headline on this article, Lenovo's Girth. With America's headquarter here, PC Maker gives region a world-class player, but one with brand product issues. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a Dateline of Mooresville. P- PC dominance is just the first step in Chinese electronics manufacturer Lenovo's mission. The end game? To net success on the admittedly uphill battle for PC Plus market share. And North Carolina, particularly Mooresville, will play a pivotal role. That's according to Jerry Smith, the president of Lenovo's Americas division headquartered in Mooresville. He defines PC Plus as a market that factors in mobile devices such as smartphones and tablets. While the company's current 16.7% PC market share is pretty exciting, he has no delusions that the personal computer sector is on the decline. Obviously, there's clearly a shift going on from an overall market usage perspective, he says. Many customers, especially in emerging markets, are buying mobile phones and tablets first. And he says that fits perfectly with Lenovo's strategy going forward. Country by country, Lenovo is starting its own evangelical smartphone movement, and that movement is making its own east-to-west migration. Lenovo started the wave by introducing its own phones in 2010, initially in its native China. From there, Lenovo tackled other emerging markets, such as India. And by 2014, North American President Jay Parker confirms Lenovo is on track to offer smartphones in the United States. But with the overt dominance of behemoths, Apple, and Samsung, the numbers reveal that a lot of work in Lenovo's favor between now and 2014 for the company to wedge a place for itself stateside. Different challenges await. Canaccord Genuity analyst Mike Walkley points out that the U.S. is a completely different animal than Asia, using another Chinese smartphone maker as an example, Huawei, spelled H-U-A-W-E-I. Last year, Huawei, similar to Lenovo, benefited from volume smartphone growth in China and entered the U.S. market, he says, pointing to a failed attempt at success. Even more well-known smartphone companies such as BlackBerry and Nokia have failed miserably. For Lenovo to crack in as a new brand, it's going to be a challenge. Brand, he points out, is a motivating factor among U.S. buyers, and Lenovo just doesn't have the name recognition of Apple, Samsung, or even BlackBerry. And the battle for tablet dominance is similarly stacked against Lenovo, and for many of the same reasons. It's a very difficult job now, I think, to get your brand noticed in new markets unless you are able to bring something new to the equation, says Tony Cripps, an analyst with London-based Ovum, a technology consulting firm. While Lenovo has seen success elsewhere, its tablets, initially introduced in 2005, are the second largest sellers from an Android perspective in China. The company has not had the same luck in North America, with ThinkPad products failing to nab customer attention away from the iPad. Smith, however, points to China as proof that it can be done. His team is embarking on a Hail Mary pass of sorts to get the Lenovo name on consumer lips in advance of 2014, an executive priority, he says. Namely, that pass involves sponsorships, such as the continuation of a deal with the National Football League, and paid endorsements by basketball star Kobe Bryant. Smith adds that on the innovation front, Lenovo has an aggressive tablet plan in the Americas that is only now in its early stages. It's a very important product for us. We know it's the future. In fact, we've got one product. I can't discuss it, but it's, we think, a game changer. The unnamed product is expected to be released this fall, he says, his only hint being that it's a unique product for the market. And that product will be among products built at the North Carolina facility in Woodset, he says, adding that the newly expanded manufacturing facility will have a role in the future, obviously, as we expand. The significance of Mooresville. Growth will mean the ability to employ more North Carolina workers, he adds, and the site in Mooresville won't be left behind. It's a pretty important site from a sales perspective, Smith says, calling Mooresville a core spot for the company and one that will reflect the company's overall growth. But for North Carolina's Lenovo presence to grow, the company has to net some competitor casualties along the way, namely by cutting into the market shares of Apple and Samsung. While it was able to successfully do that in the PC sphere from one-time leaders HP and Dell, a double-down strategy is needed in order to make a dent in the mobile space, points out Cripps. Companies need to do one of two things to expand successfully in the Western world, he says. Outcompete in price while maintaining quality being the most obvious. The general thing is, Asian companies are prepared to accept slimmer margins on devices, he says, pointing out that the sacrifice isn't always the game changer. After all, Apple keeps its success despite vastly wider profit margins than its competitors. The other expansion option is to look into ways to integrate the user experience across several devices. It's only possible if you actually build and sell all of these different devices and categories yourself, Krip says. Try to create a more holistic, integrated experience that works between those devices. Again, using Apple's iPad and iPhone as examples, he points out that there's a potential to cross-sell other devices. What I imagine we're more likely to see here is somewhere between the two, Cripps predicts for Lenovo. He says the tablet market can match the smartphone industry for competitiveness, and if that you are a branded manufacturer and your name isn't Apple or Samsung, marketing is essential, albeit difficult. I think for companies like Lenovo, as with other PC vendors entering into this space, I think they're going to have to pick their battles carefully, says Scripps, and prepare for the possibility of casualties on both sides. And there's a second article that's also part of this cover story, and it's headlined, Lenovo's Strategy to Boost Its Brand. And this is also written by Lauren K. Ansorge with a Dateline of Morrisville. Global reach aside, Lenovo has a major problem, and that's brand awareness. Despite the company's growing presence in North Carolina, visibility is poor even here. It's an opinion shared even by its America's chief executive, Jerry Smith. Obviously, becoming number one in PC market share was huge from a brand awareness perspective, he says. I personally got phone calls from people I haven't talked to in years congratulating me and saying, oh, Lenovo, I didn't know you were that big. But the company is that big, having manufactured nearly 17% of the PCs shipped in the second quarter alone. But that's not the only reason the Triangle should take note of Lenovo, say local leaders. Lenovo doesn't just create computers. It creates jobs, jobs that impact the greater Triangle region regardless of where the Chinese computer maker ranks in PC share, says Research Triangle Regional Partnership CEO Charles Hayes. It matters, he says. The trouble is, visibility remains poor. When people think Research Triangle, they think IBM, Cisco, Red Hat. It should be recognized, says Brent Lane, director of UNC's Carolina Center for Competitive Economies. He says it's hard to say why the visibility isn't there. At the very least, they are a large source of employment and could lead to spin-off companies. Exactly, says Hayes. When Lenovo decided to build its Morrisville campus, the company said the 400 jobs it would create would pay an average salary of $70,000 plus benefits. Lenovo officials won't reveal the company's current local payroll, but using a lowball figure of $50,000 per job would result in a payroll of $105 million. Lenovo points to a report from the North Carolina Department of Commerce conducted this year that estimates Lenovo's operations impact the state's gross domestic product by $630.5 million and increases state output by more than $1.01 billion. The report also shows that the position at Lenovo's global headquarters in Morrisville support an additional 3,900 jobs in the Research Triangle Park area. The economic impact is phenomenal, and I think we forget that sometimes, Hayes says. Communities used to talk about payrolls, and we don't hear that term too much anymore, and I think you should. And it's not just Morrisville, he notes, pointing to commuting patterns that show Lenovo employs people from the entire Greater Triangle region. The impact goes beyond economics, says Jason Wyden, executive director of Raleigh Startup Center HQ Raleigh. The established corporations helped to position the Triangle as one of the top five entrepreneurial communities in the country, he says, adding that by having the likes of Lenovo and IBM in the area, the region has automatic access to talent. He calls the entrepreneurial movement a collective effort by all players in the Triangle, including Lenovo. Jason Kaplan, a partner at venture capital firm Bull City Ventures, says big companies give the region visibility. When we sell the region, we promote the fact that we have big, well-known companies, first-class universities, and a fast entrepreneurial base, he says. Brooks Rayford, CEO of the North Carolina Technology Association, takes it a step further, pointing to the manufacturing facility Lenovo opened in the Greensboro area. Growing manufacturing, that is not a trend that was typical until this effort, Rayford says, noting that the sticker on computers manufactured at the facility has a map of North Carolina. That's another great branding for our state. Lenovo's presence is already increasing. Spokeswoman Malanka Mukhi says the majority of the company's 2,200 North Carolina employees work in Mooresville, with about 115 new hires in the manufacturing facility in Whitsett. About 300 work there. And along with this cover story, there's also a timeline. It's headlined, A Short But Eventful History. Lenovo as a brand came to be in 2004, though the original company, Legend Holdings, began in 1984. Lenovo, when translated into Chinese, means creativity or connected thinking. The company's triangle history primarily dates back to 2005. December 2004, Lenovo announces it is buying IBM's personal-based computing business. It's reported at the time that the $1.75 billion deal will transfer 1,900 local IBM workers to a new employer. May 2005, the $1.25 billion deal closes and Lenovo takes over IBM's PC unit. In the short term, Lenovo will relocate its workforce into four buildings in the Park Center Office Park on NC-54 and into three buildings in Pinnacle Park on Silicon Drive in Research Triangle Park. October 2005, Lenovo announces it has selected Mooresville for an $84 million 400-job expansion. The expansion, official said at the time, will bring the total Triangle workforce to 2,220. March 2006, Lenovo discloses that it is moving its U.S. headquarters, an Atlanta call center, and a Boulder, Colorado logistics facility to Mooresville. The reorganization is expected to save the company $250 million a year. Lenovo officials also announced that 1,000 full-time positions worldwide will be cut, including at least 300 in the Triangle. May 2006. The U.S. State Department says Lenovo equipment will not be exposed to classified information due to security concerns. August 2006, Lenovo hires Dell exec Jerry Smith to lead global supply operations. Lenovo is reported to have 1,500 Triangle employees at the time. January 2007, Scott Smith, president and CEO of Lenovo's operations in the Americas, resigns. Roy Reed, then Senior Vice President of Operations for Lenovo, will succeed Smith on an interim basis. April 2007, Lenovo confirms layoff predictions, saying 1,400 jobs will be cut company-wide, including 350 in the Triangle. Local headcount will be about 1,350. Incentives Lenovo has been offered require a headcount of 2,200 by 2010. May 2007, Lenovo announces a $1.3 billion deal with Microsoft to offer its software on Lenovo's computers. June 2007, Lenovo announces it's building a $10.5 million manufacturing and distribution plant in Guilford County, plans to employ 47 workers. November 2007, Lenovo announces that Scott DiValerio will become president of its Americas group effective in December. January 2009, Lenovo announces a major restructuring, 2,500 total jobs lost, including a net loss of about 100 in the Triangle. April 2010, Lenovo's downsizing gives Mooresville-based iContact an opportunity. The email marketing firm announces it is moving its headquarters from Durham to Lenovo's Mooresville campus. February 2011, IBM sells the last of its Lenovo stake. September 2011, Lenovo releases plans to build a massive global headquarters park in Beijing. Previously, Lenovo had reported that its corporate headquarters was in Mooresville, despite the bulk of its executives and administration activities being in China. January 2012, it's announced that Lenovo is expanding its Whitsett Distribution Center by 37,500 square feet. At the time, it employed 160 workers at that facility. April 2012, David Schmuck, a Lenovo employee since 2006 and a former Dell executive, is named North American Operations President. October 2012, Lenovo announces it is building a U.S. personal computer production line, its first, at the Whitsett facility. The line will be able to make the company's signature Think brand notebook and desktop personal computers. November 2012, Lenovo replaces then North American head David Schmuck with supply chain leader Jerry Smith. January 2013, Lenovo splits its personal computer business into two units, Lenovo to focus on mainstream products such as PCs and mobile internet, and Think, premium products and enterprise solutions such as servers and storage. February 2013, Lenovo announces the creation of a new Americas division that will bring in Latin American markets. Jerry Smith will lead the Americas division from Morrisville. Jay Parker, a vice president and general manager, is promoted to North American president. Lenovo confirms some layoffs at its Americas headquarters in May 2013. And in July 2013, both Gartner and IDC rank Lenovo as the number one PC manufacturer in the world in terms of market share. Now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. Shula 347 Grill in Chapel Hill closes. Famed football coach Don Shula traveled to Chapel Hill in 2008 to trumpet the opening of the Shula 347 Grill in the Sheraton Europa Hotel. Alas, it is no more. The restaurant has closed and been replaced by Carolina 1663, which features southern entrees and cheaper menu prices than did Shula's. The name of the new restaurant pays homage to an important date in North Carolina history. England's King Charles II issued the Charter of Carolina in 1663, granting the land that is now North Carolina and South Carolina to eight men, according to the North Carolina History Project. The charter was amended in 1665 to extend the boundary north to what is now the North Carolina-Virginia border. Shula's 347 Grill honored Shula's 347 wins in the National Football League. Apple Gold expands. Raleigh-based Apple Gold Group is the second largest franchisee of Applebee's restaurants, and now the company is adding 12 Applebee's in the Louisville, Kentucky market. It marks the company's entry into the Bluegrass State. Apple Gold acquired the restaurants from Charleston, South Carolina-based Whitmart. The restaurants cover the surrounding Louisville market and parts of southern Indiana. Financial terms of the deal were not disclosed. It's the second time Apple Gold has acquired restaurants from Whitmart. Apple Gold Group, headed by CEO Michael Olander, now operates 131 Applebee's neighborhood grill and bar locations across seven states. Rickshaw Gang readies to open brewery. Crank Arm Brewery, an extension of downtown Raleigh's Crank Arm Rickshaw, opens its doors to beer enthusiasts and bike lovers alike in Raleigh's Warehouse District July 29. The craft brewery and tasting room located at 319 West Davy Street houses a seven-barrel brew system and features bar and table seating for 93 indoors and 42 outdoors. Co-founders Adam Eckert, Mike Morris, and Dylan Sellinger funded the venture through an online Kickstarter campaign earlier this year, during which the team raised more than $40,000 and gained nearly 500 backers. The brew pub will offer two flagship beers, Rickshaw Rye, a Rye Indian Pale Ale, a Rye India Pale Ale, and White Wall Wit, an American Wit, with a seasonal rotation of four craft beers. Now open, Underground at Main. Underground at Main in Durham made its public debut on the evening of July 16, with entrepreneurs mingling in the hip space that already is home to 40 early-stage startups. The goal is for those startups to eventually outgrow Underground at Main, which measures 22,000 square feet, and move to the original Underground. When they're ready to hit maturity, they'll enter the American Tobacco Historic District alongside such companies as Bronto and Appia. At the Underground, we want to help launch businesses with truly innovative ways to serve real-world needs and see them grow into full-fledged successes that produce good jobs, says American Underground Chief Strategist Adam Klein. Peter Millar to open 57th Street pop-up. Peter Millar, a Raleigh-based menswear label, will open a pop-up store in New York City in October, according to apparel industry news reports. Women's Wear Daily reports that Peter Millar will take over a 2,000-square-foot space at 36 East 57th Street in New York City that is currently occupied by Mont Blanc. Mont Blanc, the timepiece and fountain pen company, is owned by Richemont SA, the same Swiss luxury goods company that acquired a majority interest in Peter Millar in October. Peter Millar will occupy the 57th Street space for about 3 months, after which luxury watch and jewelry designer Piaget takes over the New York location permanently. Peter Millar's CEO, Scott Mahoney, though, says the high-end apparel company has been looking for a permanent location for a store in New York. It opened a 750-square-foot temporary pop-up shop within the Rothmans menswear retail store on Park Avenue in April. Peter Millar has a boutique store in Southampton, New York, as well as in Palm Beach, Florida, and Zurich, Switzerland. Contributing to Biz were staffers Thompson Wall, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Lauren Onsorge. And now we turn to the A Better World page, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we come to the column written by Todd Cohen. The headline, McConnell Golf Employees and Members Tee It Up for Charities. They teamed with Urban Ministries of Wake County, donating 100 pounds of canned food for its food pantry. They worked with the Food Bank of Eastern and Central North Carolina to pack 300 pounds of potatoes at its warehouse in Durham. And they collected more than 350 pairs of shoes for Souls for Souls, a Nashville, Tennessee-based charity that since 2005 has delivered more than 19 million pairs of new and gently worn shoes to people in more than 125 countries. Since Raleigh-based McConnell Golf launched its Footprints on the Green program 18 months ago, more than 200 of its staff and members at its seven clubs in the Carolinas have volunteered more than 540 hours to support a broad range of charities and charitable events. The idea, says Lauren Berry, director of marketing at McConnell Golf, was to integrate the range of charitable activities across the clubs, giving employees at each club an opportunity to learn more about and participate in activities at the other clubs, and giving members at each club who might be involved in separate activities, such as golf, tennis, swimming, and fitness, a chance to connect with one another. It just deepens the relationship and it gives a number of different ways to experience the clubs, she says. Founded in 2003 by John McConnell, former CEO of A4 Health Systems and Medic Computer Systems, who serves as its CEO, McConnell Golf operates Raleigh Country Club and Wakefield Plantation, both in Raleigh, and Treyburn Country Club in Durham, as well as clubs at Baden Lake and in Greensboro in North Carolina, and Clinton and Pawleys Island in South Carolina. The company employs about 500 people, and membership at its clubs totals about 3,000 people. McConnell Golf staff and employees have sent and packed more than 500 pounds of food for the Food Bank and Urban Ministries in Raleigh, Greensboro, and South Carolina. They helped build a home for Habitat for Humanity of Greensboro, and they hosted a 5K run for Greensboro Urban Ministry. Two key efforts include providing volunteers for Shepherd's Table Soup Kitchen in downtown Raleigh and creating the inaugural We Care Golf Classic that will be held October 1 at Wakefield Plantation to benefit North Carolina members of the military and their families. Spearheading those two efforts have been members of the Wakefield Senior Men's Golf Association, a group of roughly 70 members over age 50 at Wakefield Plantation. And last spring, Susan Flanagan, a resident of Wakefield Plantation and a McConnell Golf member, helped organize and run a tennis event that raised more than $8,000 for the Adaptive Tennis Association of North Carolina, a new statewide organization affiliated with the United States Tennis Association that supports children and adults with intellectual disabilities. Wakefield Plantation also partnered with Rex Mobile Mammography through the Rex Healthcare Foundation for a two-day Tennis for Tatas event to raise funds for uninsured and underinsured women in Raleigh and nearby communities and provide mammogram screening. Through Footprints on the Green, Barry says McConnell Golf aims to serve the community and build those relationships with members. And now in the nonprofit news section, The North Carolina Humanities Council, a statewide nonprofit and affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, has awarded 6 grants totaling $45,000 and ranging from $3,500 to $10,000 for projects in the humanities. All funded programs are free and open to the public. The Kroger Company, which has 14 grocery stores in North Carolina, has announced that its Mid-Atlantic stores have raised $105,872 through their Honoring Our Heroes campaign for the USO. Kroger stores raised more than $3.2 million nationally through in-store donations, corporate brand promotions, and coin collection boxes. The USO is a nonprofit that has served the United States military for more than 60 years. Benevolence Farm in Carrboro has received a $25,000 grant from the Snyder Family Charitable Fund, which also provided $20,000 in seed funding in 2009, plus $120,000 in 2011 to hire an executive director and a professional consultant to help the board of directors create a strategic plan. Benevolence Farm, which provides an opportunity for women leaving prison to live and work, is in the final stages of securing a donation of land in southern Graham County near Saxapaw for housing and operation of the farm. And in our final section, People on the Move, Hopeline Incorporated named the following to the Executive Committee on its 2013 to 2014 Board of Directors: Allison McNeil, Court Administrator for the U.S. Bankruptcy Court, Eastern District, and co-organizer of Skate for Life, as President. Pam McAfee, a partner at Nelson, Mullins, Riley, and Scarborough, as Vice President. Betty Archangel of Allstate Insurance, as Secretary. And Jay McLam, Chief Financial Officer of Carly C's IGA, as Treasurer. Hopeline Incorporated provides free suicide prevention and crisis intervention help through its Crisis Line and Teen Talk Line. And now we return to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. The first page we come to is for reporter Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. The headline on this article: Building Rush On Again with 5 Raleigh Projects. The Raleigh Planning Commission has given its collective approval to proposals for 5 major real estate development projects in all parts of the city, including one that dates back to 2011. Here are details on them. Edison Office. Like so many other ambitious projects proposed downtown in the pre-recession years, the developers of the Edison Multi-Tower Development Project have scaled back their plans. The 13-story Edison Office Building is slated to have 305,934 square feet of office space and 8,841 square feet of retail space. Beacon Partners, led locally by Greg Sandruder, is the developer of the $60 million project at 313 South Wilmington Street and East Martin Street. The Point at Creedmoor. The developers of The Point at Creedmoor think they have finally hit upon a plan that will work for the undeveloped corner lot at Millbrook and Creedmoor Roads in North Raleigh. Harris Teeter has signed a lease to anchor the 7-acre project after the property was rezoned to allow for development of a shopping center. The owners of the site, York Development Group of Charlotte, had in 2009 reached an agreement with the city to build a pharmacy with 3 two-story office buildings, but Walgreens ended up building a standalone building across the street instead. The L Building. It's back to Plan A for developers of the L Building in downtown Raleigh. When Greg Haddam's Empire Properties in 2006 first proposed a plan to build commercial space around Wake County's parking deck at McDowell and Davie Streets, the group wanted to build residential condo units, but condos at the time were falling out of vogue with financiers, so they switched the plan to office space and covered the blank walls of the parking deck temporarily with colorful mural banners. But the plan for office space didn't work out either, and now Empire Properties has gained approval, again, to build up to 100 residential units atop retail at the L Building site. The Gramercy. It's been nearly 3 years since the partners of Blue Ridge Realty submitted their plans to build a seven-story, 209-unit apartment complex at the corner of Glenwood Avenue and West North Street in downtown Raleigh. Called the Gramercy, the project was at the time one of four multi-story, multi-family properties proposed within a three-block radius in the Glenwood South District, but only two of those are currently under construction. Plans for the Gramercy have since been revised to a five-story, 203-unit residential building, but brothers Joseph and Victor Meir are still in charge of the project. And finally, the Shores. Construction of the first new townhouse units at NC State University's Centennial Campus would resume this fall after the project previously known as North Shores was delayed by legal disputes between the project's previous partners 7 years ago. Roland Gammon of White Oak Properties in January submitted a revised plan for the townhouse and condo project, now called The Shores, that incorporates 44 townhouse units and 64 condo units on the banks of Lake Raleigh. And now we have Chris Bagley's page. Bagley covers transportation, law, and energy. The first article is titled, Hey, Big Givers. The Sunlight Foundation, a project of the nonprofit Center for Responsive Politics, recently compiled a database of the top 31,385 individual political donors from the 2012 elections. The number represents 0.01% of the nation's population of 313.9 million people as of July 2012. It calls them the 1% of the 1%, a play on the class divide that the group Occupy Wall Street began to decry in 2011. Following are some of the top triangle donors. Fred Eshelman, Republican, $1,514,500. Eshelman founded PPD Incorporated, a pharmaceutical contract research organization whose largest locations are in Wilmington and Morrisville. He also founded and is chairman of Furex Pharmaceuticals in Morrisville. He has recently donated to Utah Senator Orrin Hatch and $1.5 million to RightChange.org, a so-called 527 fund. He has also made sizable contributions to Democrats, including Representative Mike McIntyre. Jim Goodnight, Republican, $111,600. Goodnight is co-founder and CEO of SAS Institute, the Cary-based business analytics software company. His contributions include $27,500 to Mitt Romney's presidential campaign and $5,000 to George Holding, who won a congressional seat in November. John and Virginia Sal, Democrats, $131,600. SAS co-founder and executive VP John Sal is just as blue as Jim Goodnight is red. Well, almost. Like Goodnight, Sal is a graduate of NC State, but the two men have given huge amounts of money to political opponents over the years, even as they cooperatively oversee SAS's growth. Robert Luddy, Republican, $188,000. Luddy, the founder and president of Captive Air Systems, contributed $55,000 in 2012 to the YG Action Fund, a super PAC that supports candidates aligned with young guns, Republican congressmen such as Kevin McCarthy and Eric Cantor. Michael and Amy Tymon, Democrats, $153,182. Michael and Amy Tymon of Chapel Hill topped the list of Democratic donors in North Carolina with total contributions of $158,182 in the 2012 election cycle. Michael Tymon is Red Hat's vice president for open source operations and a member of its senior management. Amy Tymon is the author of Mojo Mom, Nurturing Yourself While Raising a Family, and High Water, a novel for young adults. And the headline on the next article, Loan Source Sues Vendor But Loses and Pays $1.3 Million. Brad King must have been gritting his teeth on June 12 when he agreed to pay $1.3 million to the company he had sued. Loan Source, King's Cary-based office supply company, had alleged in January 2011 that its primary supplier, United Stationers Supply Company, had unilaterally raised paper prices in late 2010 despite an existing contract. United Stationers sued back with allegations that Loan Source had violated their contract by ordering too much paper from other suppliers and eventually dropped Union Stationers altogether. Loan Source representatives didn't respond to a request for comment. The company's strong growth has earned it spots as high as number 3 in 2010 on Triangle Business Journal's annual Fast 50 list. Its list of lawsuits has also grown. Here's a rundown. Loan Source sued SunTrust Banks Incorporated in October 2004, a few days after SunTrust merged with a Loan Source customer. Loan Source alleged that SunTrust wasn't properly interpreting the contract after overtaking it from the predecessor bank. SunTrust countersued with allegations that Loan Source failed to live up to a guarantee that it would reduce its prices. The two companies agreed to drop the dispute in 2006. A credit card company sued Loan Source in October 2010 over $472,295 in allegedly unpaid travel charges by Loan Source employees in Georgia. A Georgia businessman who sold his company to Loan Source in 2008 sued Loan Source 3 years later with a dozen allegations, including defamation, dealing in bad faith, and being stubbornly litigious. A former employee in one of Loan Source's two Georgia offices said the company threatened him with legal action after he resigned. The employee sued in Georgia State Court in November 2011, saying that Loan Source should be blocked because its threat was based on an unenforceable provision in his employment contract. After 17 months of sparring with United Stationers, Loan Source and King paid the $1.3 million within weeks, says United Stationers attorney Mark Finkelstein of the law firm Smith Moore Leatherwood. And now we turn to the page of Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. The headline on her article, Where Big Data Lives, a tour of Sentinel's Center. Today, if you step into one of five 10,000-square-foot chambers at the new Sentinel Data Center facility in Research Triangle Park, you can hear a pin drop. In a few weeks, however, when tenants move in, the whir of machines and mechanical bustle will present an entirely different scenario. We're really excited, says tour guide Brian Baker, also the vice president of business development at Sentinel Data Centers. He's among the local faces in an industry that, with increasing vigor, is picking North Carolina as an investment opportunity. Sentinel's facility, to be 420,000 square feet, is a prime example. Along with the Triangle's reputation for having a good talent pool, the Tar Heel State has something that's an even bigger driver. Power costs, he says, pointing out that electricity in North Carolina costs about a third of what it costs in other tech-heavy markets. That's why you saw Google, Facebook, Apple come here as well. Each of the Sentinel Center's five chambers will house the big data operations for a large company. While said companies will provide their own equipment, Sentinel has an important job to do, one that's even more important than maintaining the square footage. We manage all of the power and security, Baker says, and the name of the game is redundancy. That's why backup generators and specialized equipment to regulate the power are standard implemented here. It's also why massively complex cooling systems circulate water from underneath the hot machines to a cooling station outside. It's all about protecting the data, which, if interrupted, could cause a company to shut down. If power is interrupted for 6 minutes, one of several generators kicks on. With enough diesel, the data center can be powered indefinitely, Baker says. But as two different substations power the data center, the chances of a complete power disruption are lessened, Baker adds. Baker and company aren't the only game in town. Windstream, which purchased local outfit Hosted Solutions, is continually looking for opportunities to invest in the Triangle. Kevin Farnham, vice president of sales, says there's a big difference between real estate type companies such as Sentinel and his outfit. Windstream provides IT equipment and support, better for smaller companies that don't need the space Sentinel is selling. Most companies don't need thousands of square feet, Farnham says. They need a handful of cabinets to meet their needs. That's where Farnham and team come in, taking care of the details so companies can concentrate on other areas such as business development. But there's one thing all data center companies have in common right now, Farnham notes, and that's opportunity. Companies are deciding to get out of that business, Farnham notes, adding that data centers are a difficult business. So if I'm any of the biotechs or pharma companies, I've been building my own data center for 30 plus years, and these companies are deciding that's not very attractive to run by myself. And as data center companies see the value in investing in the Triangle, companies are all too willing to be Triangle customers. It's a really good thing, Farnham says. And now we turn to the Spotlight article in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal. And the spotlight is on healthcare. The headline for the article, Stop Loss Plans Provide Backup for Self-Insured. With the advent of the Affordable Care Act, companies look to take on own coverage. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. A new law awaiting the governor's signature would make it easier for small businesses to manage their own health insurance risk, potentially a favorable option as new federal health insurance regulations come online. A growing trend in the health insurance world is to find ways to self-insure. That means that instead of seeking health insurance through a fully insured plan from a Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina or an Aetna, for example, the company actually collects premiums and pays out claims directly. This puts more risk on the employer, of course, and small businesses where claims are far more volatile than in a large company have not usually had the appetite to take on that much risk. With the Affordable Care Act, particularly the provision that calls for community rating, smaller plans with low risk profiles will likely see their premiums increase sharply in 2014 and 2015, leading some small businesses to look for alternatives. Self-insurance with safeguards could provide just that alternative. For self-insured plans, financial companies offer what is called a stop-loss or catastrophic insurance. This protects a self-insured company from incurring major medical claims in any one year. The company will pay claims up to a certain dollar threshold, then the insurance company will cover bills after that point. Without a stop-loss policy, one or two major medical events could literally bankrupt your company, says Rick Kelly, an actuarial expert with Raleigh-based benefits consultant Progressive Benefit Solutions. The new law would define exactly what kind of stop-loss coverage small employers, those with between 26 and 100 employees, may buy. Specifically, the stop-loss would kick in at $20,000 in medical bills for any one individual and 120% of total expected claims for the year. That figure is negotiated between the employer and the stop-loss insurer. This gives a smaller employer the ability to manage their own risk, says Chris Schaffner, Vice President of Practice Development at Physician Care Direct in Cary, who helped write the bill. In a small way, this could bring health insurance to a place it was in the 1940s, he says, because small employers can have more autonomy over their plans and can form alliances with local health care providers. This could spur some smaller micro-networks, he says. I think you will see a refocus of keeping that health insurance money in the community. State Representative Tom Murray, a Raleigh Republican, helped shepherd the bill through the legislature. The expanded availability of stop-loss coverage to groups in the small group market should lessen the disruption caused by the ACA, he says. The bill was ratified and presented to Governor Pat McCrory on July 16. As of July 22, he had not yet signed the bill into law. And our next article, written by Lauren K. Onsorge, with the Dateline of Research Triangle Park, the headline, Old is New at Didsbury's T3D on Drug Candidate. For veteran local executive John Didsbury, the stakes are high. Didsbury, with his new startup, T3D Therapeutics, is banking on a drug candidate that isn't exactly new, DB959. The former GlaxoSmithKline manager had worked directly with the compound as chief scientific officer at Dara Biosciences in Raleigh. But what he's trying to do now is a world away from the compound's former diabetic indication. He is attempting something many before him have tried and failed to do, successfully treat Alzheimer's disease, and his weapon of choice is DB959. How can a one-man startup make a difference in a disease that has already foiled the efforts of pharma giants such as Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson? The key in Alzheimer's disease is that it's a disease that involves multiple pathologies, says Didsbury. Most pharma companies are really going after a single-dimension approach. That single dimension is often targeting the brain plaques associated with the disorder, but that's not T3D's target. This compound is really an avant-garde approach to treating the disease, he says. It stems from the reduction of brain sugar metabolism. And that's a predictor of cognitive decline, he says, noting that clinical symptoms of Alzheimer's don't occur without decreases in that glucose metabolism. Neurons become resistant to the actions of insulin, he explains. They become insulin resistant, and without the ability to use insulin, these neurons die, and the result is cognitive and functional decline. He says adding T3D's compound can address multiple pathologies of Alzheimer's disease. DB959, licensed last month from DARA, is a dual nuclear receptor, mounting what he calls a multidimensional attack. And it has already been tested in the laboratory. DARA had previously developed the candidate through Phase 1 clinical trials for the treatment of diabetes and dyslipidemia, and no significant safety issues have been found. This is really innovative science, he says. This is not consensus science whose hypothesis is now weakened by the failures of others, he says. And he is targeting doing a pilot clinical trial in moderate Alzheimer's patients later this year or next year. The company, which just closed on an undisclosed amount of seed financing from angel investors, is embarking on a Series A round of funding through the online platform Polywog. And he feels investors will understand his thought process that Alzheimer's and not diabetes is the better bet for T3D. With diabetes, there's not that large an unmet medical need, he explains. There are a lot of good drugs out there, and it is extremely difficult to get investments, given that any new diabetes therapy will require the conduct of large cardiovascular outcome trials, which can cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Didsbury doesn't have a personal connection to Alzheimer's, but calls his research a mission regardless. It's been a personal mission of mine over the past 25 years to identify and push through a breakthrough medicine for a disease, he says. After careful study, this is the one I have put my faith in. But after decades of witnessing and participating in repeated failures in the Alzheimer's space, outside researchers aren't so optimistic. Take Dr. Murali Duraswamy, a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor at Duke University, who agrees that brain metabolic defects are a promising target. That said, every anti-diabetic drug tested in AD has failed to date, he says, so the odds of a repurposed drug working out are low. Dr. Daniel Coffer, director of the UNC Memory Disorders Program and co-director of Carolina Alzheimer's Network, however, says it's a good approach even though the odds are mounting. Research such as Didsbury's provides a bigger picture than one of just plaques, he says. It takes Alzheimer's out of isolation and really brings it into the same playing field as other common medical disorders, he says. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. House nixes bill transferring ownership of Wake Schools. House lawmakers on Wednesday nixed a bill that would have stripped control of Wake County schools away from the school board, WRAL reports. The vote was 52-64. Specifically, the legislation would have transferred oversight of school construction and maintenance away from the school board to the Wake County Board of Commissioners, which would have made Wake the only county in the state in which the school board did not have such control. Republican backers of the bill said the transference of control to the Board of Commissioners, which is majority Republican, would have enhanced the prospects of an $810 million school bond that will appear on the voter ballot this fall. Democrats asserted Republicans were engaging in a power grab to steal control away from a left-leaning school board. 21 Republicans broke rank to vote against the measure. Cherokee Investment Partners announces winner of Startup Challenge. Cherokee Investment Partners, a Raleigh-based private equity firm with nearly $2 billion under management, has announced the winners of its 2013 Cherokee McDonough Challenge. Three Triangle-based startups, BioMason, Home Wellness, and Platinix, were selected as winners of the Green Technology Incubator's third annual challenge. Each will receive $20,000 in startup money, free office space for 3 months, and a chance to meet on a weekly basis with some of the top venture capital and investment advisors in the Triangle and across the country. Vantage South moves stock listing from NASDAQ to NYSE. Vantage South Bank has moved its listing to the New York Stock Exchange from the NASDAQ, another step in its leaders' plans to transform it from a quiet community bank into a $5 billion bank holding company. The bank's parent company has also changed its name to Vantage South Bank Shares Incorporated from Crescent Financial Bank Shares, and its stock to VSB from CRFN. The changes already are in effect. The insurance company entrepreneur Adam Abram and longtime banking executive Scott Custer have been building up the company for a couple of years now. Highwoods investing $118 million in Orlando office buildings. Highwoods Properties has paid $113.3 million to buy out the 60% ownership that its joint venture partner has in five office building properties in Orlando, Florida. Highwoods is also planning to invest $7 million in near-term building improvements, bringing its total investment in the properties to nearly $118 million, according to a news release issued by Highwoods this morning. Highwoods' joint venture partner in the Orlando properties was Capital Consult, a European investment firm that is affiliated with DLE. And North Carolina gets $3 million for bioterror warning system. North Carolina's early warning system for biothreats nabbed a $3 million cash infusion this week. U.S. Representative David Price, a Chapel Hill Democrat and ranking member of the House Homeland Security Appropriations Subcommittee, announced that the North Carolina Biopreparedness Collaborative, NCB Prepared, had netted the additional funding from the Department of Homeland Security. The project, spearheaded by local universities and private businesses, is developing what it hopes will be an innovative biothreat early warning system. And we're going to stop right there because we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.